I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers online courses to the public through partnerships with leading universities internationally. Coursera was launched in 2012 and reached its first 1 million users faster than Facebook or Twitter. Coursera is one of a number of companies offering massive open online courses, or MOOCs, that had been launched in recent years to address a growing global population and the rising costs of on-campus higher education. Daphne is a professor of computer science at Stanford University. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica. It's a pleasure to be here.
What are some specific features of a Coursera experience?
So the Coursera student experience is an attempt on our part to give to students all over the world an experience that is as close as possible that we can get to being on campus. The course starts on a given day. Every week the students are responsible for learning some content. There's homework that's due every week, which is graded. And if you don't do your homework, you don't get a grade and you don't pass the course. And then there's a rich social community of students around the course that are working together to help themselves deal with the challenges of this difficult material.
What is the age range of the people enrolled on the system?
We have students that are as young as 10 and students that are as old as 90. I got an email from an 86-year-old that tells us that she doesn't feel comfortable going to college because people are going to look at her funny. What's this old lady doing in class? And so she is taking a Coursera course and meets up with a bunch of other octogenarians every week in the public library to do a study group.
And how about internationally? You're touching students in several hundred countries.
We're touching students in every single country around the world. I mean, every single country that the State Department defines as a country has Coursera students in it. We have students in Iran, we have students in Pakistan, we have students in Ghana and Kenya and South Africa, students in Australia, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, China. I mean, you name it. So just a couple weeks ago, I got an email from the modern contemporary American poetry professor at Penn who told us about a student from Pakistan who had taken the course remotely and has done so well that it was part of his admissions package to Penn, and now he's coming to study at the University of Pennsylvania. We have a student from Peru who took a bunch of our computer science courses because there weren't a lot of computer science courses available to him in Peru, used that as the basis for his Fulbright application, and is now coming to study in the United States as a Fulbright scholar.
You co-founded the company with Professor Andrew Ng, who is also at Stanford. Stanford has a history of computer-assisted learning that, you know, dates back to, I'd say, the 1960s. Can you describe the nature of the computer-assisted learning?
Mm-hmm. So Stanford has a very long history of distance learning. It started out, I think, as you said, back in the 60s, where they were filming courses in class and then shipping literal video cassettes to local industry sites so that students could watch the video cassettes, and then they would mail in their homework and their graded homework would be mailed back to them. This is how long back this goes.
When you say students, these were students actually at local companies in Palo Alto, such as Intel.
That's right. These are students who are local or not even local. Some of them were in Oregon, for example.
And they were employees of these companies.
These were employees of these companies.
And Coursera is also videos of the professors, of the lectures, but it's much more interactive this time.
Well, that's one of the differences. But the other difference is that the lectures are not, by and large, lecture capture of what happens in a live classroom. These are videos that are prepared intentionally for online consumption. And that changes the student experience dramatically because once you move away from the constraints of in-class teaching, you have a lot more freedom. So first of all, you don't have to teach at 50-minute segments. You can teach at 8-minute segments that are much better suited to students' attention spans and to the granularity of the topics. You can also do things that are much more creative, like record some stuff in a workshop or out in the field, for example, making things much more alive to students.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers university-level online courses to the global public. When was the idea for Coursera hatched with you?
If you want to trace my history in Coursera, it actually goes way back before we even thought of Coursera. Yeah. I've been involved in teaching efforts at Stanford ever since I got there and have been interested in the use of technology in teaching all the way back to 2008 or 9, which is when a group of us were summoned to by Stanford administration to just discuss how students could become more engaged with their instructors at Stanford, how you can create more interaction. About 2 months after that meeting, I happened to be at a Google faculty summit where they bring faculty from all over the world to discuss ideas, and I was listening to a talk on YouTube, and it occurred to me that this provided a medium by which we could create really high-quality course content that could be presented to students outside the classroom with a lot of additional engagement beyond just the lecture. And then when students came into class in that precious time when the students and the faculty were actually in the same room at the same time, you could actually talk to each other and do stuff together. Problem solving, creativity, case studies, things like that that we never have time to do in real classes. And for me, that was the first step that eventually morphed into Coursera a few years after that.
Your co-founder, Professor Andrew Ng, also came to online education through his own personal experience. What was that briefly?
So Andrew, back in 2007-2008, started a project that was aimed to take some of Stanford's great content and make it available to the many people who are not privileged enough to have access to a Stanford quality education. And so he created a project called Stanford Engineering Everywhere, which took 10 of Stanford's most popular engineering classes, cleaned them up, and put them up on the web for everyone around the world to make use of.
Incidentally, SEE, or Stanford Engineering Everywhere, has reached over a million people at this point.
I think it's that effort combined with some of the ideas that I developed in the context of my class at Stanford, that by combining these different ideas is how we arrived at a lot of the vision behind what turned into Coursera. And that really culminated in the fall of 2011 with a grand experiment that Stanford did in which it launched three courses and in computer science and made them open to everyone around the world for free. We were expecting an enrollment of a few thousand people in these courses. They were pretty advanced courses in computer science, but within weeks, each of them had an enrollment of 100,000 students or more. I think that that opportunity and the magnitude of it is what caused us to effectively put our respective careers on hold, and in my case, also my family on hold to a certain extent, and really walk into what has turned out to be an incredibly exciting but also time-consuming endeavor.
Were you and Andrew friends since you were in the same department, or?
Actually, Andrew and I had been friends even before he joined Stanford. We even wrote a paper together while I was a very young faculty member at Stanford, and he was still finishing up his PhD at Berkeley.
Coursera has partnerships with Stanford, yes, and universities ranging from Princeton to the University of Pennsylvania to a Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And while Stanford's attitude towards using its content has been one of openness, there has been initial concerns about making the university's content available to the public. Some might feel, why should we offer content for free while students who attend our university are paying northwards of $40,000 a year? What do you think has made universities comfortable with adopting Coursera as a partner?
I think universities are realizing that this is a transformation that's coming, and it's coming regardless of whether they engage with us or not. And many universities feel like they would rather be helping to steer the train as opposed to sitting on the sidelines to see where it goes. At the same time, I think that most of the universities, I would argue all of the universities that are working with us, realize that their value proposition to their students is and had better be about more than just offering content. If content is about to become free and ubiquitous, then what they would like to do is to open up more time in the curriculum for this active engagement with students, which is really what distinguishes the best universities.
Right. It's going to have, this change is coming, and whether they want to be friendly to that and part of that and active agents rather than on the defense is what they're up against.
Online education, when we started doing this, was something that was looked upon with a certain amount of skepticism and even disdain by most institutions. And now it's something that every institution realizes that they're going to have to embrace in some form or another. So somebody told me something the other day that I think is very smart. They said that the term blended learning in 10 years is going to sound like the term horseless carriage. There's not going to be any other kind.
So it's not just launching a company, but you really are pioneering an industry to some extent.
I think we are helping to pioneer the first major transformation in the landscape of higher education since the invention of the printing press. If you look at medicine, for example, and you list all of the inventions that occurred in the last 200 years, there's a ton of them. There's antibiotics and orthoscopic surgery and anesthetics. I mean, you can list them and you'll have pages. What were the big inventions in education and in higher education the last 200 years? You kind of scratch your head. Whiteboards versus blackboards? PowerPoint? I mean, there really is not very much on that list.
You have raised venture capital from Kleiner Perkins and NEA. And while you are a for-profit company, you certainly have a social mission. You are mindfully Coursera.org versus Coursera.com. Can you elaborate on that decision?
I think both Andrew and I are educators and went into this with the primary goal of offering education to everyone. We went into this as a for-profit company, partially because people told us if you're going to become sustainable, this is a way of doing it in a disciplined way. I'm not starting to rely on charitable foundations and encounter donor fatigue. And partly because that was our way of getting enough seed capital to get this going as a viable effort.
Now, regarding the business model, how do you see becoming profitable? Right now, you offer courses free.
Mm-hmm. Well, we intend to continue offering courses for free because once you start charging money, you block access to this to the people who need it the most, the people who can't afford even $5 or don't, in many cases, even have a credit card. So how do you make money if you don't charge for access? Well, so we have a couple of different directions that we're pursuing. One of those is charging for credentialing, and we've recently started to offer this notion of an authenticated credential where a student identifies themselves using a government-issued ID, and then every time that they submit work, they have a biometric profile that allows us to ensure that they are, in fact, participating in the learning process. This is not a super costly thing. You know, average is about $50 per course to participate in that, and we've had quite a good opt-in to that, and it's entirely optional. Second model, which we think is very interesting, is we've had a lot of institutions come to us and say, we would love to be able to offer this course to our students, but we don't have anyone to teach it. Can we take your course, adopt it, wrap around some instructor guidance and facilitation by an instructor who might not be an expert enough to prepare the course, but can still provide help to students as they make their way through it? And all of a sudden, our students are now able to graduate with a much richer transcript than they could before. That makes them much more marketable.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera. We'll hear more from Professor Koller coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers online courses to the public through partnerships with leading universities internationally. Daphne is a professor of computer science at Stanford University. You're charging a small fee for this verified certificate, but still that precludes a large percent of the population from taking the course. How are you addressing that?
So from day one, we told our engineers, this is not going out without a financial aid program. There's a student from Chile, for example, who, for family reasons, wants to study Huntington's disease, wants to do a PhD, and is taking our Minds and Synapses course so as to be able to improve their application and have a greater chance of being admitted to its PhD program. We have a student from Egypt, a doctor, who is studying the nutrition class so that she can better serve the people of her community despite the fact that she gets no support from the Ministry of Health in Egypt. We have a student from Bangladesh who is taking our energy and sustainability course because he realizes only 53% of the citizens of his country have access to electricity, and he's hoping to be able to provide access to electricity to the other half of his country.
inherent in any companies getting off the ground are some problems early on, whether they're technical glitches or plagiarism in your case, or questions surrounding grading. You have adopted, in some circumstances, peer grading, where there's more subjectivity around a paper that might be submitted. A student has to grade four other papers, and it's anonymous, so they don't know who the participant is. Can you talk about just the nature of that decision?
There are certain types of work that currently computers just can't effectively grade, and that includes designs, for example. It includes essay questions that require deep thinking, causal reasoning, and so on. Computers just can't grade that right now, and certainly not provide useful feedback to the students. And since we wanted to support courses that require that kind of work, we put together this peer grading mechanism. Now, I agree that it's something that has to be designed very carefully. You can't just take a lay student who's learning the material for the first time and tell them, here's another paper, grade it. Mm-hmm. The instructor has to put a lot of thought into creating a what we call a grading rubric, which defines the criteria by which a paper is supposed to be graded and how each of them is to be applied. And those have to be very carefully specified so that the student, even though they're not expert in the material, can take somebody else's paper and say, yes, these 3 points were made, and yes, these 5 references were given, and so on, so that they can provide a robust and reproducible grade for the work.
It's not perfect, but don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Excellent. Exactly so. And actually, let me add to that, that one of our professors from Princeton, Mitch Denier, actually tried out this notion of the perfect being the enemy of the good. He had two of his teaching assistants grade all of the final exams in his sociology course, and it was a hard final exam, and then compared the results from the TA grading to the results of peer grading, and they were very, very well correlated. Mm-hmm. Now, that was a very well-designed grading rubric, and of course, if the grading rubric is not well designed, this is not going to be as good. But for a well designed grading rubric, it's actually pretty darn good.
You mentioned Professor Mitch Denier. He's a sociology professor at Princeton, and he had 40,000 students take his course from over 100 countries. Can you provide more texture to his experience?
Yeah. So Professor Mitch Denier taught one of our earliest, in fact, arguably our earliest humanities course, because it was a very humanitarian sociology class, not a very quantitative one. And he tried this interesting experiment where, in addition to his weekly lecture materials, he also had a weekly video chat with 10 students selected from different countries around the world. So a student from Nepal, from India, from Georgia, the country, from South America. And he says that he learned more from one instance of teaching this class to a global audience than he learned from teaching it for 12 years at Princeton, because at Princeton, every year there is a great discussion, but it's very similar from year to year because the students have very similar backgrounds. Whereas here, in one go, he got such an amazingly broad range of different perspectives.
We alluded to this before, but can you provide more examples of the types of people taking the Coursera courses, from the traditional student to the octogenarian?
Sure. So our courses span the range of ages. So I mentioned that we have 10-year-olds. There was our algebra instructor from UC Irvine said she went into the park one day and there were a group of 10-year-olds playing, and they came and said, oh, you're the Coursera lady. It's so great to meet you. We're taking your algebra class. And they all hugged her. So that's one example. We have some less happy stories, I guess, of people who don't normally have access. So one example is a student who is a 17-year-old boy who's severely autistic. His name is Daniel, and he has been in special ed his entire life. I should say he has a speaking vocabulary of about 150 words, but he types on an iPad and is able to communicate very effectively with a very rich vocabulary. And he was the star student in the University of Pennsylvania Modern Contemporary American Poetry class. And he says this is the first meaningful educational experience that he's had after a life of special ed.
What's another example? Yeah.
So a couple months ago, we got an email from a woman who happens to be a Stanford alumna and has stage 4 breast cancer. And she says that she can't really leave the house except to go to the hospital to get her chemotherapy, and that this class is her one window into the outside world. Hmm. We have one of our earliest story is a father of an immune-suppressed baby who couldn't leave the house because his baby was getting immune treatment therapy, and he was bone marrow transplant, and he was afraid that if he would leave the house, he would bring in germs to infect her. And so he spent the time while there taking some of our courses and learning more about computer science, and ultimately ended up getting an internship in a database company on the strength of that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, an online education company launched in April 2012. Its goal is to provide the global public with access to a university-level education that has previously been unavailable on a wide scale. Coursera has partnerships with more than 60 global universities, including Stanford, Northwestern, University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Tokyo. Some people look at the disruption of the online education space and draw the analogy or the parallel to journalism and newspapers, how you had all this valuable content that was being undercut when digitalization came. Journalists' skilled work was being given away for free. And what do you see as a parallel industry or a parallel disruption?
So I think that, you know, digitalization is something that transforms an industry. It creates new leaders, and it creates new job categories and opens doors that were closed before. So let's take, for example, electronic commerce. Certainly, it created a consolidation of a number of key marketplaces like Amazon and eBay, where a lot of sellers are now congregating together with a lot of buyers to create a marketplace that is actually very efficient. In some ways, it enabled things that were local mom-and-pop shops that were that had only a very small local audience, if they were efficient and forward-thinking, to all of a sudden reach out to people around the country. So when we were redoing our kitchen, I ended up buying a bunch of doorknobs from a mom-and-pop shop in Florida. So I think that this really creates opportunities to as it also transforms the entire sector.
We're talking about disruption, and we're so at the early stages, it's hard to know what the long-term impacts of some of these are. But we have cell phone usage that is rampant. What changes are going on even biologically with our brain circuitry, you know, as a result of our usage of social media all the time? And I wonder if are the changes in our brains, are if those changes are making online education perhaps maybe not better distribution platforms than traditional education, but have you thought about that marriage?
Well, I think that there's a lot of changes that are occurring in today's young people that make this, in many ways, a better dissemination platform for them.
For better or worse.
For better or worse. So I think the fact that people are so used to consumption of content via digital media is making them much more open to getting content in this way. And the fact that we're able to make that content sort of shorter time span, much more intensive, much more interactive, is a lot more commensurate with how they react to other content in their lives. At the same time, I think we're also leveraging on the fact that they're used to getting so much of their interaction via digital media. I have two daughters. They're 8 and 10. They sit in adjacent rooms texting each other. I mean, they could play together physically, but they like texting each other. They like texting me. So I think that people today are actually much more receptive and interested in participating with each other via digital media. And we're capitalizing on that.
You are acquiring a lot of data. You're seeing how people are learning. What are some interesting nuggets of information that you've gleaned from the number of people taking these courses? Whether you've incorporated this feedback into the company is another matter.
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest opportunities that we have here is to take the study of human learning and turn it from an anecdotal science into a data science, because the amount and quality of the data that we're getting is just unbelievable. So you can start to look at, for example, which are effective mechanisms for pedagogy in an online format and which aren't. So, for example, in collaboration with a group at Stanford, we tested the question of whether showing the instructor's face in the video is a good thing or a bad thing. There's people who say that it distracts from the content and people that say that it humanizes the experience. And I wish I could tell you what worked better, but I can't, because the students who weren't seeing the instructor's face complained bitterly that they were unable to focus because it wasn't sufficiently engaging. And so the experiment had to be stopped in the middle. So I think that at least here is something where we know what the students think they want. If it's actually more effective, I don't know, but it's certainly what the students think they want.
What's another example?
So a very preliminary example that we did is, does sending students email telling them that a deadline is tomorrow and that they better log on and do their homework, does that increase or decrease student retention? You would think that it would increase student retention. It turns out that the answer is a little bit more nuanced. If you just send students an email telling them that their homework is due tomorrow, they feel like they're being nagged, and it actually decreases retention. The email needs to be much more carefully constructed with something that tells them not only that their homework due, but they're really doing well in the course, they're 80% along in the course, and kind of something that encourages them at the same time.
The global footprint of Coursera is vast, but can you break that down? Can you provide some more stories?
When my class was first offered on Coursera, I got an email from a student who lives on the Afghan-Pakistani border in a war zone, who told me that he had to leave school after a year to go support his family, but he really wanted to take my class and was wondering if I could offer him a scholarship. And I told him that I didn't need to offer him a scholarship because it was free. And he said, "Really? So can I take two classes?" And I said that, yes, of course he could take two classes. And then he wrote me back to say that he promises to repay my faith in him by going down to the internet cafe in his village, which is the only place that he has an internet connection, so that he would be able to do his homework every week. So that's one example. We have a student in Kazakhstan who took a number of our courses and ended up, on the strength of that, being able to get a job at Twitter in Kazakhstan. He's now working remotely. We have a group of students in Iran who, there's serious network connectivity issues there. Not everyone has access to the internet. So my colleague Andrew Ng was told by one student that the student was downloading all of his lectures and burning them on DVDs to distribute them to people around the country so they would have access to lecture material, for example, even if they didn't have internet access.
What about in Ohio or someplace in the United States?
Yeah. There's a group in Ohio that has formed where a wonderful, wonderful woman took a group of students who, by and large, had very little college education, but had a lot of motivation. And she put them together in a community center. They met once a week, and they took the University of Virginia Darden course on Grow to Greatness. And she sent me a picture of the group. And, you know, it's people, by and large, in their 40s who've had a very difficult life. They work all the time, and yet they carve time out of their schedule to try and learn something new and become and have a better life as a consequence of that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers university-level online courses to the global public. Coursera is one of a number of companies offering massive open online courses, or MOOCs, that had been launched in recent years to address a growing global population and the rising costs of on-campus higher education. You are from Israel, and you come from a family of academics. Your father was a botanist, and your mother taught English as a second language. I'm kind of curious about your father's botany. Do you have an interest in botany?
No, I don't. I think my father was disappointed that neither of his children expressed an interest in botany. But interestingly, my father's story is that he really wanted to be an engineer. And he even started out studying to be an engineer, but he was told at the time, Israel is a very young country, that the thing Israel needed most was not engineers, but rather agriculture. So he went from being an engineer to being to working in botany, which is the basis for Israeli agriculture. But I think throughout his life, he was a bit of a frustrated engineer. And the part that he enjoyed as much as anything was building all sorts of cool measurement devices for his plants. And so I think that in retrospect, my father and I had a lot more parallels than our different paths in life suggested.
Right. Israel, obviously,'s land is quite arid, and they've had to be very resourceful in growing its food. And
that's right. But I think the funny part is that now, of course, Israel's biggest industry is, in fact, its engineering and high-tech industry, and my father was just born at the wrong time.
Did you serve in the Israeli army?
Yes, I did. I was a lieutenant in military intelligence.
This was in the 1980s? Or
yes.
Did you read Startup Nation and how Israel is more entrepreneurial because of the military experience that they have?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, Israel is more entrepreneurial because of the military experience. I think it takes young people and puts them into a position where they have a really significant mission that they're trying to live up to. It's resource constrained, and you're supposed to make do with what's available. You take a person, you say, you have to do this. There isn't much money. There isn't a lot of equipment for you to do it with, but do it anyway.
What's an example of that resourcefulness?
The examples that I know are all classified. Sorry.
You are the Rajiv Motwani Professor of Computer Science at Stanford, and Rajiv was an advisor to a number of startups in Silicon Valley, including Google. Actually, Google endowed this professorship.
Endowed chair.
After Professor Motwani died. Did you have interactions with Professor Motwani when you were...
Professor Motwani was actually on the faculty at Stanford when I joined as a graduate student back in 1989. When I came back to Stanford as faculty back in 95, we were actually in that same research group from which Larry Page and Sergey Brin emerged and created Google. It was part of the Digital Libraries group at Stanford, and a lot of the early discussions around how to rank web pages occurred in the context of that group. So I've known Larry and Sergey since they were back when they were still graduate students at Stanford. Rajiv was a tremendously gifted individual, and was, I think, one of his greatest strengths was his ability to bridge the theory and the practice. I think that was a part of his ability to help guide people like Larry and Sergey into areas that would make so much impact. And the chair that is endowed in his name is intended to be for people who similarly bridge between theory and practice. And I'm very privileged to be able to hold that chair. It's a real honor.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera. Coming up, we'll meet Mario Schlosser, co-founder of Oscar. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mario Schlosser, co-founder of Oscar, a company that's focused on making health insurance easier and more accessible. Oscar has built a simple online presence that helps users connect directly to doctors, get prescriptions, and find insurance plans that are easier to navigate. Prior to Oscar, Mario worked at the hedge fund Bridgewater in Connecticut. He's originally from Germany. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be on the program.
Oscar is primarily like a web-based internet company, and I think of the incumbents, these behemoth insurance companies with like mountains of paper, and just vastly different from your profile. How is it possible that you are doing the same thing?
Yeah, great question. It actually doesn't happen that often that a technology company comes around and says, I want to be an insurance company. From the beginning, we knew if we are going to walk into the regulatory offices up in Albany in New York State, for example, with just a bunch of coders, just a bunch of programmers, we wouldn't be invited back. You know, so the team we built from the get-go was a team that's comprised of, on the one hand, computer scientists like me, designers, and also a very healthy contingent of very experienced insurance executives. So our chief actuary is the former chief actuary of Emblem, the biggest plan in New York State. In short, what you need to have to become an insurance company is you have to have a lot of money. The regulators will ask you to block away tens of millions in reserve capital, in making sure you can really insure people, that no surprise on medical underwriting losses or gains will financially be an issue for you. And so this is what we do in different states. We're licensed. We block away tens of millions in reserve capital. You have to have a network of physicians and doctors. So you have to go out and actually strike relationships with the people who actually deliver the healthcare. Mm-hmm. And then I think the third thing really is you have to build a incredible backend system where the information that we have on our members' care and our members' medical conditions is so transparent to our nurses on the team, to our customer service members on the team, and to the doctors who work with us, that we can just give you an answer when you call us and get you in with the best possible doctor whenever something's happening to you.
In addition to just providing more transparency to users, you're also changing healthcare practices, like behavior in a way. Like, for instance, telemedicine is probably more prominent in your company than otherwise. Can you talk a little bit about some of those behaviors?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the healthcare system is full of a lot of innovative doctors who really want to help you and take care of you. And a lot of times, the way the system is currently set up kind of gets in the way of these things sometimes. Mm-hmm. Your doctor does not get paid by anybody I'm aware of if he emails you or if he answers a phone call for you. That stuff does not get submitted to the insurance company. And so we, from the beginning, said the power of becoming the insurance company is we can start paying for these things. We can start paying for the things in the way people nowadays want to consume their healthcare, and we can maybe stop paying for a few things in the way, you know, doctors shouldn't be delivering healthcare.
So what's an example?
An example actually is televisits. We became the first insurance carrier, really, again, to our knowledge, across the United States, where every member has 24/7 access to telemedicine, which means you push a button and a physician will call you back on average about 9 minutes. And we push your full health history out to the doc. He then picks up the phone, calls you back, and then all the notes he takes will come back in real time into our own systems. You can see if the doctor writes you a prescription. You can see which pharmacy this goes to. You can see when the prescription is ready to pick up at the pharmacy and things like that. And we pay for all that. And you can just consume as much as you want. We don't provide the care ourselves, but we can definitely always get you in touch with the right provider and with the right node in the healthcare system.
So you co-founded the company with Josh Kushner. His family is a real estate family. They own a lot of real estate in New York, as well as Kevin Nazimi. And Josh runs a venture capital firm called Thrive, and Kevin is a former Microsoft employee. And Josh really was the one who came up with the idea for Oscar. Can you talk more about kind of his vision initially?
Two things that happens. One is he had played basketball or whatever and sprained his ankle, went to the ER. His mother was there with him. And he was just kind of dumbfounded by how weirdly obtuse the experience is. You know, when do you actually leave this emergency room? He probably got a thousand times photocopied, discharge notes kind of thing when he left that emergency room. I had no idea what's happening to him. And what happened to me at the time was my wife was pregnant with our first kids. And so we were trying to find a pediatrician and a good OBGYN and go into a hospital that wouldn't have too high of a C-section rate because we wouldn't have a natural birth. And all these questions where if you called your insurance company, I'm not sure how much of an answer you would really get that is satisfactory to these questions. And so against that backdrop, Josh said, let's start an insurance company. And the point, I think, where I really, as a sort of computer scientist again, with a real need to get better healthcare as well, got excited is when I realized two things about insurance companies. One was the insurance company really sits in the middle of all this data and information flowing through the healthcare system. That was one thing. And the second thing was the insurance company also controls the way the financial incentives work in the system. You know, they could pay for free televisits. They could pay for when your doctor is nice and emails you back on his Gmail accounts. That's what a nice doctor does, you know. And so the insurance company could do something about this, but in my experience, hadn't done anything about this stuff.
Now, you met Josh. You were a student in Harvard Business School while he was a student at Harvard College. How did you meet?
I was at McKinsey for a few years. I went to HBS saying, all right, enough of this consulting stuff. I want to get back to starting some companies and back to programming. And so I spent my 2 years basically just writing codes. One of the things I was building was a social network for no particular reason. MySpace was kind of at the peak, I think. You know, Facebook had just come out. And so another friend of mine at HBS by the name of Daniel Caffey from Honduras, he had this idea of saying, let's start a Facebook for Latin America. And so Josh and him and I got together about that idea and then did that as well.
You brought on board very early on Kevin Nazemi, who was at Microsoft. Why did you include him in the mix?
He, I think, was the most healthcare-oriented of us. He had worked at a healthcare IT company, essentially a company that built a claim system in the summer at Harvard Business School. And so from that time, he actually knew a few people who were involved in or who had been executives or were executives in insurance companies. Mm. And so one of the very first people who was an insurance executive came through Kevin. Then that guy's name is Dave Henderson. He's still in the team. He's still one of the important people in the company. And, you know, the guy who had the requisite and necessary gray hair, which I now have as well, to explain to us how regulation works and all that kind of stuff.
You needed to raise a lot of venture capital because, as we talked about, you know, in order to get approval in these states, you have to prove that you have a pile of cash. And your first venture capital came from Thrive Capital. And other people joined on board, like Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal, and Vinod Khosla of Khosla Ventures. Can you talk to me about that venture capital process?
Yeah. Oscar, very much, and probably this is true for many startups that end up being successful, in many ways is a right place, right time kind of thing. You know, so if you recall that I was talking about early 2012, what didn't enter the equation for the first 6 months really was the fact that there was the Affordable Care Act coming. We had no idea, to be honest. Oscar was not a deliberate play on regulatory change in the healthcare system. It was really, okay, this experience stinks. Let's try to do something about that. Then we realized there is a very narrow time window for the first time in 20 years and probably never again in the next 20 years to start an insurance company because the individual market is coming. The ACA, Affordable Care, creates this market where individuals for the first time buy insurance, where you can build a brand, where you can build tools that people would fall in love with and really want to engage with, and so on. And that took a while to really figure out. When we then talked to the first venture capitalists, we talked to all of the big guns. What was funny to me there was that they all had a different idea of what the Affordable Care Act does, and it was wrong in all cases. None of the guys, the venture capitalists at the time, had on the radar screen the fact that there would be a giant market created overnight of individuals buying insurance.
And this is all made possible by the Affordable Care Act that Obama instituted in 2012, which basically allows individuals to buy access to health insurance, and the insurers can't turn somebody down even with a pre-existing condition.
That's exactly what it is. You can't get turned down. Everybody pays the same price. It was very much a chicken and egg game at the time. You know, we had to, on the one hand, get deep enough into a regulatory process to show to the venture capitalists that this would become a viable entity. And then also show to the venture capitalists we are deep enough in a regulatory process that they think they should, that we think they should fund it. You know, and that was a difficult thing. And I think what was kind of interesting to me in hindsight was as a founder nowadays, when you go to a VC, and you show them a video, you know, you sort of say, hey, here's a mock-up of how I think my site will look like, my product will look like. They will laugh you out of the room. You know, they would much rather see from a technical founder a listing, a code, some codes, you know, like on the screen. Like, here's my Xcode or whatever with a bunch of stuff I can compile, you know, and you can look at it and see how it works. If we had pitched that way to regulators, they would have thrown it out of the room. And so we actually went to the first ever regulatory meeting we had the day after Sandy, the hurricane. We kind of like trekked up from Manhattan and drove up to Albany. And we actually had a video, an animation of how we think the product would eventually work once everything gets pieced together. And that got the regulators very excited because they've never seen this. You know, they were at the time fighting with the big insurance incumbents, trying to drag them into the Obamacare exchanges. And then once we went to venture capitalists, we actually showed, no, we got the, you know, we are in the regulatory process and now fund this in time for regulators to get comfortable with and eventually issuing the license.
Who was an early investor who really bought into this? What was the first serious capital you got?
Instrumental, I think, was General Catalyst up in Boston. And Joel Cutler, the leading partner there, was actually the sort of like guy who groomed Josh to become a venture capitalist. And so one of the first tracks we made was up to Boston to pitch to Joel and his team. And the instrumental guy in that team was a guy named Charlie Baker, who actually nowadays is the governor of Massachusetts. So Charlie Baker had been the CEO of Harvard Pilgrim, one of the biggest insurance companies in Massachusetts. And Joel eventually, he turns to Charlie Baker and he goes, okay, Charlie, what if we took this thing and we sent it to one of the big carriers? What would happen? And then Charlie goes, I don't think they would know what to do with it, you know? And so then Joel is like, you kind of see the light bulb go off in his head, and he realized what the sort of like competitive advantage could be.
You have positioned yourself as like a company that wants to keep it simple, right? Mm-hmm. And wants to keep healthcare and health insurance simple. And your ads help to perpetuate that. They're kind of quirky and cartoonish. I kind of think of like emojis.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me about that evolution? Like give examples of some of your Subway ads,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, when we tried to put together our first campaign, this is in late 2013, we thought, okay, somehow we have to stand out. And so the campaign we came up with was a really very simple one where we have just a monochromatic background and one funny line on there, and then some sort of like very simple, somewhat cartoon characters or drawings that draw some additional attention. And a couple of the lines would be have a nice articulate doctor call you back without joining a dating site, or health insurance that won't make your head explode, and if it does, you're covered.
Right. Why were your investors in Silicon Valley kind of reluctant to have you put up these Subway ads?
There was one investor, I'm not going to tell you who it is, where we had a lot of fights in kind of late 2013, and it wasn't really at the time very popular for a technology company in New York to be in the subways. It was sort of like applying the classical Silicon Valley maxims and axioms to how you build a user base to this thing, and including also all the usual Silicon Valley bullshit terminology, and subway ads really weren't part of it. And we just really thought that if we only do online ads, right, that we would never really get members' trust, because we sort of felt you had to see us in a couple other media channels before you would really believe that Oscar is a viable insurance company here to stay. And so the Subway ads became far and away the most visible thing, I think, for us in hindsight.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mario Schlosser, co-founder of Oscar, a company that's focused on making health insurance easier and more accessible. What has been harder than you thought in all of this? I mean, because you knew it was going to be pretty intractable, but what has been even harder than you thought?
Well, I think the complexity of the industry is absolutely breathtaking. So typically, I think if you talk to any technology startup, you don't build technology for, you know, the edge cases, the edge use cases, for the thing that you expect once in 1,000 years or so. You build technology for, you know, what the majority of users will fall in love with and want and so on. That's not something you can do in insurance. Every single, this is a saying we have internally, we literally sometimes say, oh, this is extremely unlikely, which means it will happen next week. Because any single combination of a number of incredibly remote variables will happen to you. And the problem in insurance is, There is a correlation between how unlikely something is and how difficult, costly, and impactful in somebody's life it is. Mm-hmm. We had a member literally who was about to lose one of his limbs because one of his physicians told him he will have to lose his limb. And then in a conversation with one of our nurses, we were able to get him in touch with a different caregiver with a more modern view of the condition he was going through, who was able to help him save his limb, and then and member ended up baking cookies for the office. Member who we had helped go through this case in a good way.
Here you are now living in New York, yet you're German. Like, do you have any recollections of, you know, your experience with the German healthcare system growing up, or
yeah.
I don't know any?
I think. I definitely do. I mean, two things I remember. One thing is my family physician in Germany. My family physician there is a guy, he's in his 70s, and he kind of shuts down his practice every afternoon at 4 p.m. or so, gets on his bike and bicycles around town and visits the old people who are in his practice and kind of like delivers the care in their home. Why the hell does he do that? He does this because this is actually his financial incentive to do. The German government, the way it reimburses him is it pays him a quarterly stipend to take care of every old patient on his panel. And so that incentivizes him to make sure these people actually don't come to his practice. He wants to make sure they're healthy. And so he'd rather see them at home before they come in, get sick. And then he has to actually, you know, do much more with them than he otherwise would if he just kept them healthy.
Right.
And so that is one of the fundamental problems in U.S. healthcare, that's not the way U.S. healthcare works. You know, here a doctor gets paid on a fee-for-service basis every single little thing you do when a person comes to your practice, that's what you get paid for. Nothing else you get paid for. Okay, so that's sort of like one recollection I have in the way the systems are different. The other one I have is actually also kind of interesting. The interesting thing in Germany is that even though it is more socialist and everybody has insurance and the government pays for it and so on, there is a tier of insurance. It's called actually private insurance that you can only buy if your income is beyond a certain level or if you work for the government. And so my father is a middle school teacher, which counts in Germany, used to count as working for the government, basically. And that's why I actually was able to go, when I dislocated my shoulder, for example, to a doctor who wouldn't see patients who are in public insurance. And it's a very odd sort of like island of pure sheer capitalism, you know, in this sort of like ocean of more equitable thinking about insurance that I actually found kind of weird. And so it shows the complexities of designing the right kind of healthcare system. And I think what I take away from it is that I very much like the fact that, if you want to get political for a second, that in the US there is competition in the healthcare system. I like the fact that we as an insurance company were able to found a competing health insurance company and try to rewire the underlying healthcare system we reimburse and drive change in the system from the perch where we sit.
So I'm going to switch to your personal life. You are married to a Brazilian woman and you have two children. How did you meet your wife?
I met her actually, this is probably the meeting place where Europeans and Latin Americans meet in New York in front of Marquee, the nightclub.
Oh.
So, which is not a story we're necessarily proud of, you know, but she is a PhD in biology and she came here from Brazil and worked as a postdoc in a lab at Columbia University. And so, you know, we had something to talk about right away.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mario Schlosser, co-founder of Oscar. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.